to welcome everyone here tonight, and we're glad that you have the interest in spiritual things to be with us, to spend a few minutes worshiping God and to study a little bit from His Word. Let me say at the very beginning that I don't generally like to hear speakers begin by explaining how they chose the particular topic they chose. Seems like it takes away from the lesson. But of course, like most things, once you get in the situation, you understand why people do that. And that is that you feel obligated to explain why. If this is your one chance out of many other chances that you don't get, why you selected this particular topic. This is a lesson I've done here before, and I'll just say that so that if during the lesson you begin to feel that you've heard all this before, that'll explain it. But to feel that way, you will have had to have been here some time ago in the past, and probably you don't remember it that well. And many of you here were not here at that time. But this is a lesson that has been on my mind a lot recently in the last few months as I see myself growing older and see others around me dealing with age, dealing with sickness and sadness and so on. And it just seems to me that we don't talk about heaven enough and look forward to heaven and think clearly about what it is that we look forward to in heaven. Now that I've announced the topic to some extent, I'd like for you to just think about your own thoughts here. What do you think the lesson will be like? What will I be describing? What book of the Bible will we be turning to, for the most part, to find this information out about heaven? Well, this will be a little bit different. We'll probably not look in Revelation at all to describe the city that has the golden street and so on. That's a figurative book, and that's a figurative description of a real place, no doubt. But I'm not sure how much we can learn beyond the beauty and the great desirability and so on that's there. I'd like to look at some other passages that describe something about the destiny of those that follow God, because really that's what heaven is. In the final sense, it's the destiny of those who have set out in their service to God to be dedicated to Him. I remember when I prepared this lesson feeling a little bit troubled by my ability to talk about it for this reason. I remember it was in the spring, and I remember because I was sitting in the office at our other house, and it was in the time of the year, or like about now, when it's not too hot yet to leave the windows open, feel the breeze, but the birds are there and the leaves are green. The day was peaceful and sunny, not too much unlike yesterday or Friday, you know, where the weather is just fairly pleasant. And I'm not sick at the moment and wasn't at the time. And I had to look around at the very pleasant surroundings that I had and a comfortable home, plenty to eat, a lot of things to enjoy, fun things to do, hobbies and other things of entertainment. Not only that, I have a fine relationship, a wonderful wife. Now I even have more kids than I had at the time. And they're good boys, and they just bring joy over and over into my life. And I have a fine church to be a part of that's peaceful and it's wonderful. Not only that, I have some sense of duty and responsibility here at the church and where I work and a little bit in the neighborhood and so on. And I have this sense of fulfillment to some extent in that I have that responsibility to discharge, and I'm able to do that fairly well. Not only that, I am on occasion recognized for that. That is, people will say, you know, you're pretty good at that. You do okay when you teach or when you do this kind of thing at work and so on. Now I begin to stop and think, am I really ready to give this up? This is awful pleasant. I don't know that I like the idea of going somewhere else. And when you think about the kinds of things that we do enjoy in life, there are sensory pleasures, there's the sense of belonging or relationship that we share with others, there's a sense of responsibility or duty or accomplishment that really brings a lot of satisfaction to us. And then there's this idea of recognition that we sometimes gain. Now, my first reaction is kind of, well, really, I shouldn't have those desires. You know, maybe I put too much emphasis on pleasure and on responsibility and recognition. After all, that's the ground of sin, isn't it? All that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the vainglory of life or the pride of life, that's the way Satan reaches us. That's the first reaction that we have. And another troubling thought, I guess, that comes in right on top of that is, what is your picture of heaven? What is the picture you would see in a cartoon of heaven that most people have as kind of their cliche for what heaven is about? Where are the people? They're floating on clouds, right? And what are they doing? They're playing harps. Does anybody like harp music? It's all right, but forever? Forever and ever? And Jesus said some things that on first hearing are a little bit troubling, and he says there's no marriage or giving in marriage. And our picture of people who have died, those disembodied spirits, is not that they would have very much fun, actually. I mean, it'd be hard for them to walk on the golden street if they're floating all the time. They wouldn't actually be concrete enough to enjoy any of the things available in that city with the jewels and so on that are there. Well, I would suggest to you that conventional wisdom is probably not the best place to go to understand what heaven is about. But, you know, it may be that those desires and those things that are pleasant in our life may be a good starting place. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, you can tell a person's destiny by his character and by the things that are true about him. When you look at a small child and he picks up that ball and first try, whoa, throws a strike. And you can tell that guy is destined to be an athlete. Now, if he doesn't like doing that, he doesn't have that destiny, does he? But if he likes it and that's all he wants to do, there's a suggestion that given that nothing tragic happens and given that something else doesn't divert him, he's probably destined to be a good ball player. And you can see in the character of David, for example, a shepherd boy, and what did he accomplish? Well, he'd taken care of the sheep, but he'd also killed a bear and a lion by trusting in God. And you could see in his past, even as a small boy, the destiny to be the king of Israel. And God saw that, and we had a lesson not too long ago about how God judges the character. So it may be that looking at the things in our life that we enjoy, that are motivations to us, after all, who put them there? Well, God did. They're part of our nature as created by God. So we have things like pleasures of the senses. We have relationships and belonging, families, churches, communities, and so on. We have accomplishment and responsibility, and we also enjoy recognition, the things we mentioned before. Now, there are probably other things. I think there are some psychologists. For those of you who've had a psychology course, I think there's a hierarchy of needs that's very similar to this, maybe built upside down, where, you know, the first thing you want to do is be able to breathe and eat and so on. Those are the lowest level of needs. Well, once you're not hurting, then you'd really like to have something at a little higher level, a sense of belonging in some place. And then you'd have to like have a sense of meaning or purpose. And you'd like a sense of recognition. And those are kind of the things that motivate us as people to work hard, to do good things, or sometimes, if they're used by Satan, to do bad things. He's using these same tools, of course. What I'd like to do now is look at the teaching of Jesus as found in his own words and also the words that he revealed through the apostles, and look at and see if our destiny does not include really the ultimate satisfaction of these things. You remember when Jesus was on the earth, he used many parables to describe the kingdom and the ultimate end of the kingdom. You remember how often Jesus used the image of a feast, a wedding feast. What's a feast about? It's a celebration, isn't it? A lot of food and entertainment and enjoyment and people sharing together in that enjoyment. In the parable of the talents, which we'll look at several times, it's in Matthew 25. Do you remember what Jesus said to the man that had gained 5 more talents? He said, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will set you over many things. Enter thou into the joys of thy Lord," suggesting that there was something he was really going to enjoy as a reward for his faithful service over those 5 talents. When Jesus said, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth," he's saying that there are some pleasures for your senses, things you can have and enjoy in this earth, but that's the wrong approach. He said you should be laying up those treasures, and I would have to assume by parallel reasoning that those must be things that would be enjoyed sometime in the future. That is, in heaven, laying up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where they're not subject to decay and so on. So this idea of having joys and treasure and feasts and so on are very important to understand our ultimate destiny. We'll be looking in 2 Corinthians 5 and in 1 Corinthians 15 quite often because it's in those passages where there's this discussion of what happens when the earth is over with. We have these four kinds of needs which we'll talk about. I'm trying to say as point number one about our destiny that heaven fully and permanently fulfills our needs. If you look at 2 Corinthians 5, first of all, beginning with verse 1, Paul says there, "We know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation which is from heaven, if indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we are in this tent groan because being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up of life." You know what the problem is with this kind of enjoyment that you think about on this earth? Is that it's, well, there's a bunch of problems with it. First of all, it's unfairly distributed. People that really deserve it oftentimes don't have that kind of thing. And pain and sickness and some kind of tragedy gets in the way even at the youngest part of their life. Another thing that's a problem with that is it's kind of limited. Think of the most intense pleasure you can imagine, riding the roller coaster and coming to that big dip and you just shoot down and it's just so thrilling that it almost gets you dizzy and you could almost see yourself passing out with the intensity of that experience. Now ride the roller coaster again. What happens the second time? It's almost as good, isn't it? And then the third time. And finally you got to try it with your eyes closed or it's just kind of boring. And then you got to try it with your hands in the air and your eyes closed. You see what I mean? And after a while, you just get tired. And you can't ride it anymore, or the park closed, or whatever. It's limited. Think of the most intense pleasure you have. It just doesn't go on forever. It stops. It's limited. So it's unfairly distributed. It's limited. We obviously understand that all of it's temporary as we grow old. And we begin to lose the ability to enjoy those things. And your health gets in the way of a lot of these things that you've enjoyed throughout your life. I know in this thinking of this passage in 2 Corinthians 5, this idea of a new body, we talk about this some in our family. And we have a need for some new parts in our bodies. We need a new pancreas, and we need a new middle ear. And we need several other things. And I know some of you here need some new parts, a new back, a new hip bone, a new vein for a leg, maybe a whole new leg. And you know, that kind of limitation in our life begins to make us realize that these things are really not fully enjoyable. They're not dependable. But what we really want is the ability to enjoy those things. And I would suggest that what the Apostle Paul is talking about here is a real body. A real body. And I don't think we're going to have swap out of parts after having said what I just said. I think we're going to start from scratch and get a body that's suitable to the spiritual nature that we have at that time. Not to say, though, that there won't be real pleasure and real joy to be enjoyed there. Someone asks sometimes, well, what about those people? It says when the dead are raised. What about those people who have been cremated and their ashes have been spread to the seven seas of the earth? How are we going to get all them back together? And what will it be like? People that maybe their bodies aren't in any real decent shape. Well, look over in 1 Corinthians 15, because almost as if someone had asked this and the Apostle Paul answers them. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 35, "But someone will say, how are the dead raised up, and with what body do they come? Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. And what you sow, you do not sow that body that shall be, a mere grain, perhaps wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. What goes into the earth that's buried in that coffin or is cremated in that urn or whatever they do that in is not the thing that's going to come up again. It's wholly different. It's entirely new and suited for its new existence. And he illustrates that in verse 39 by saying, all flesh is not the same flesh. There's one kind of flesh of men and of beasts, another of fish and another of birds. Depending on where you are And what you're supposed to be doing, you have a body given to you by God that's suitable for that activity. So it isn't as if we'll just be repaired in some way and regenerated in this earthly existence. We'll have something entirely new that has grown out of that spiritual part of us that survives and then is able to, in the fuller, deeper sense, share in the spiritual pleasures that are to come in our next life. Let's think about relationships. With regard to relationships, you know there are limitations even to that. In the first place, a relationship here depends on the consistency and the character of another person. Have you ever thought about that? The ideal marriage is still dependent on two people and the other person being everything they need to be. Furthermore, many relationships are temporary and can be affected by the wrong influences. When you look at our destiny, you have to see, first of all, the image of marriage quite often in the discussion of Jesus and the church. In fact, John the Baptist, one of the first things he says about Jesus in John chapter 3, immediately after the account of the discussion with Nicodemus, John the Baptist talks about the bridegroom is coming, and I'm just standing by as one of the groomsmen, I suppose. And later, the other John, who wrote the first one but wrote the book of Revelation, describes the bridegroom coming, and the church was the bride adorned for its husband, for her husband. And so you see, just in the very imagery of where we're headed, this close union of husband and wife, as we understand it in a physical sense, is applied to the relationship that the church would have with Christ. Jesus said in Matthew 8, after healing agreeing to heal this centurion's servant, he talks about, I see Isaac and Abraham and Jacob all sitting down in the kingdom of God with those that are there. He said this to a Gentile, of course. And what he's saying is that all the world comes and sits at this place in this giant family with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He also adds that some of the actual Jews won't be there. They won't be in that family. But there's this sense of coming together as an enormous family from all parts of the earth and having that larger relationship in heaven one day. Paul talks about that Jesus is the firstborn among many brethren, Romans 8 and verse 29. And Paul also says that his certain expectation was that if he died, he would die and be with Christ, that relationship of being with Jesus. You see, that's a relationship with a consistent being, someone that's dependable, that won't change, that's eternal through the ages, a real relationship, if you will. In 2 Corinthians 5 again, we can see this same reference here. Continuing on where we finished before, this idea about having a tent that's replaced by a building, partially clothed, being fully clothed. In verse 5 he says, now he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who also has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. Therefore we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith and not by sight. We are confident, yes, well pleased, rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. You see the idea of how we have now in this second existence that he's describing, a close relationship, a presence with the Lord, as a better relationship and a better, closer sense of belonging and a more permanent bond. But what about responsibility and accomplishment? Have you ever thought about what we would actually do in heaven? What would we do? Now, I know there's the pictures of the saints singing and praising God, which is something Christians ought to enjoy doing and love doing. And I don't know if we can be very specific about what that would be, but I just have the feeling that if God has placed this desire within me, this inclination to want to accomplish something and to accept responsibility, it's very likely that there'll be something to fulfill that in a fuller sense in heaven someday. Here's some indications. Look again in Matthew 25 when it talked about the parable of the talents. You remember that that incident? What did Jesus tell the man who had discharged his duty well with the 5 talents? He said, verse 23, his Lord said, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. And then look down to verse 29.
verse 28, in fact. Remember the man who didn't do anything with his? Therefore, take the talent from him and give it to the man who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. Cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I won't make any specific application because I don't know exactly what it will be. But don't you see an indication here that the discharge of our duties here properly over the 5 or the 3 or the 2 or the 1 talents will result in some further blessing that would in the life to come? Look at another indication from Luke chapter 16. This is the parable of the unjust steward. And if you remember, without going into a lot of detail about this, you remember the notion here is that the unjust steward saw that he was going to be discharged. He was going to be kicked out of his house because he had done some things that, well, he deserved to be kicked out. But in the interim period, before he was actually dismissed from his duties, he used the things at his disposal to go and forgive the debts of those other debtors of his master, so that when he got kicked out of his house, he was going to be received into a second position. And here's the lesson Jesus draws from that. He says, verse 8, so the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly, not because he was dishonest, but because he was clever. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into eternal or everlasting habitations. See what he's doing? Some of these are strange words, but he's saying you live in a world of physical things. They're not spiritual. All we have to deal with is money. All we have to deal with is our physical body and our earthly talents. But if you use them in the right way, you can plan for the next life and you can be received into eternal habitations, he says. And look at the lessons that he draws in verse 10. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. There's this notion, it seems to me, that we're on trial on how we're going to, you know, discharge our duties here. We've been given some resources and some talents, and how we manage those may have something to do with our reward in the next life. Verse 11, therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, that's now, that's what we have to work with now, who will commit to your trust, the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, and you know everything we have is God's, we make that point quite often. We're just stewards of what we've been given, our bodies, our money, our time. If you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you that which is your own? And so whatever it means, it seems to me that this purpose and responsibility may also reflect the destiny that we have in our next life. Whatever it means, it appears that Jesus will set us over the true riches that we will own for ourselves and have some responsibility there, further carrying out the responsibility that we began in this life. And finally, recognition. There are a lot of problems with recognition as something that we enjoy. And the lesson this morning was an excellent example of how a dependence on earthly recognition really can build itself into a really fairly sinful attitude. If I'm dependent on being thought highly of by others or comparing myself to others so that I'll stand out in such a crowd of men in general, that's really one of the best tools Satan can use to create a wrong attitude within us, a prideful attitude. But we can't escape the fact that we want to be recognized. You see the dilemma there? We really are, we feel good when people recognize us. And the difficulty is we can't use that in this life as the reason for doing things. Some of the problems are that you don't always get recognized for the things you ought to be recognized for, that is, by men in this life. But you know how that works when we have a meeting here and maybe the big name preacher comes in. And he comes down and, hey, Marty, how you doing? Everyone noticed that he knew Marty by first name. And you know when the president of the company comes through and maybe he happens to know you and you're recognized by him, how good that feels? Or you work very hard and some club gives you an award. Have you thought about how many awards there are in this life? Awards for plays and music and poetry and freedom and rescuing people and other kinds of things. Just about every organization you're part of recognizes
that people like to be recognized for what they do. And that's really what we should do toward others, as Matt talked about this morning, our children in particular. But the problem is, that shouldn't be our motivation. Because Jesus said, if you do it to be seen of men, you have your reward already. What does the next life offer with regard to this need that we all have to be recognized? You probably know the answer. What did Jesus tell those that were on his right hand? Remember in Matthew 25, when he separated the sheep from the goats, he said, come, you blessed of my Father. As if he knows them all, and he calls them by name, and he said, these are the ones that are mine. Can you imagine the honor of being recognized by the Creator of the universe by name? By name? Jesus said, if you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father who is in heaven. Jesus actually calling your name out and saying, this is one of mine. Paul talks about a crown of life in 2 Timothy 4. These are images that we understand. And in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents that we just read, what did the man say when he came back? He said, well done, thou good and faithful servant. He was praised for what he had done. And now we begin to understand what this desire to be recognized ought to be used for. Who is it that we want to recognize us? Who should be, in our minds, the one we want to be recognized by? And the answer is God, of course. And everything we do should be done as in purpose, looking to the time when God would recognize us. Let's look at the passages that we've talked about here. In particular, let's look at 2 Corinthians 5 again. In this context that we've just finished reading about being at home with God, in verse 8, following that, he says, we are confident, yes, well pleased, rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Therefore, he's looking forward to that time when he's with the Lord. In verse 9, we make it our aim, whether present or absent, now or then, he says, to be well pleasing to him. Look what he says in verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he's done, whether it's good or bad. This idea of being recognized by God for what our works are should motivate us even now, but as a sense of filling this desire, this actual desire for recognition, to be recognized by God. There's another interesting word that's used in this text. If you look back up to chapter 4, beginning with verse 14, he says, therefore, and the context here is, of course, Paul as an apostle struggling with the dishonor that this earthen vessel that the gospel's carried in, that is his own body and his duty as an apostle, that's a burden to him, and it's painful, and it's difficult to discharge. But he says in verse 16, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. What is this glory? What does it mean, glory? We sing that song, that will be glory for me. That's a word we use so much, I wonder if... I know a lot of times it doesn't have any particular meaning attached to it. Glory. Glory. What is that? What is it? Look back in the other passage we're looking at, 1 Corinthians 15. And after discussing the fact there are different kinds of bodies suitable for different kinds of animals who live in different kind of environments, in verse 40 he says, there are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies. And I assume by that he means heavenly bodies. But the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another. There's a glory of the sun, glory of the moon, glory of the stars. One star differs from another in glory. What's he talking about? In what way are the planets and the stars and the sun? What glory do we see? Well, in the most literal sense, it's just the light that comes from it, right? And you see the moon looks one way, and it has a certain amount of light, and stars have another, and some stars have more than other stars. But there's the idea of a light shining. And that same idea is seen over in verse, back in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where it talks about the glory of the gospel. The influence of the gospel is shining into the earth,
carried around in these earthen vessels, and see if you don't see the connection of glory and light with respect to the gospel. Verse 3 of chapter 4, 2 Corinthians. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. You see the connection again with glory and light? Now, how is this idea of light going to be? What does that have to do with being recognized? And do you see that if something is lit up, it's seen. It's noticed. It shines. Remember what Jesus said I think it's in Matthew 13, in the parable of the wheat and the tares. And after finally they all grow up together and the servants come through and they get rid of all the tares, he says, then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Can you imagine that? That bright golden field of wheat is, I guess, the picture he's calling to mind. But there's this notion that what I am now is fully seen and fully recognized, not hidden by some earthen vessel of a body. But that spiritual nature that just begins as a seed in this life now is being fully recognized and shining as a star or as a sun, as Paul talks about here. The idea of being recognized or being noticed, it seems to me, is carried by this idea of glory. And not just any glory like a star or a sun, but eternal glory, seen and recognized forever. That's a real satisfaction of those desires. So the first major point, which is going to take most of the time, is that really, when you look at the desires that we have in this life, heaven is the only place that they'll fully and permanently be satisfied. And here are some examples of how that's the case. But there's another idea I'd like to talk about, and that is that we do have these desires in this life, but I think we need to understand that this life is really only a shadow of our true destiny. I think we can illustrate that in the passages that we've looked at without looking at them again. You remember the idea of a seed that we saw in 1 Corinthians 15, a seed that was planted? The seed dies, and what actually comes out is far better than the seed. It's a whole plant that's full of other seeds, you see. It's much better. Not only that, in 2 Corinthians 5, we saw the illustration of a tent. A person who's living in a tent, he may do that for some time while his real house is being built. And the comparison is of a temporary, fragile, flimsy, uncomfortable tent, but later he has the full building. And you can read that in 2 Corinthians 5. Another interesting imagery is in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 2, the idea of only being partially clothed. You get up in the morning, you still have your pajamas on. You're not ready to meet the day. And if you go outside without the sufficient and complete clothing, you're going to be uncomfortable. And it isn't going to be pleasant. You're not really complete. But here he says, we long to be fully clothed. It's interesting there that he also says, it isn't that we don't want to have any clothes on. What the idea is there is, we'll really never just be a spirit without a body. We're not going to just be floating around. That's fearful to us, isn't it? Have no way of expressing our thoughts. That never happens. What happens is we get a bigger, better, more solid, more permanent body, which he describes as being fully clothed, the proper clothing. And then in Romans 8, a passage that we haven't looked at, but we have in the class that we've had on the side, it talks about the fact that in this particular situation, we're groaning with the whole creation. We groan with the imperfection that's been placed here by the sin of Adam. We groan because of the temporary nature. We groan because of the conflict between good and evil. We're uncomfortable with that. And it's as if we're in bondage to that. You know, a person who's a slave or in bondage, and he ought not to be, and he just imagines being free and having the ability to break those bonds. And that's what the next life is described as. And he describes in that very text being free, set free from that bondage that we suffer in this particular life. Now, I make all these points to make a much more important point about the fact that our life is only a shadow of our true destiny. Really, really two. One is, I suppose, a good one. You remember the difficulty I had in preparing this lesson was that I have so many pleasant things in my life. And sometimes it's difficult for heaven to seem needful. But really, if we think about it in the proper way, we can see that
whatever small amount of pleasure, relationship, accomplishment, recognition I have in this life ought to really just make me hungry for what's to come. If I see it in the proper way, as a foretaste, as a shadow, I can see in the relationship I have with my wife, I can see in whatever minimal pleasures I enjoy when I'm in good health and the weather's good, and all this, everything seems to be just about right, I can begin to see what heaven might be like a little bit. Only a shadow, only a seed, only a tent compared to the building, and so on. So it is, a lot of times we focus on suffering as the time to preach about heaven. Maybe a better time might be when we're really kind of doing okay. And we begin to think, you know, it could be a lot better than this. And it seems to me a person who thinks to themselves it doesn't get any better than this, that's despair, isn't it? If that's all there is, it doesn't get any better than this, it's going to get a lot better than this. But let's measure that by the very best experiences we have in this life with regard to relationship and accomplishment. That's one important point. But another and more significant point, it seems to me, is that we often forget that it's the shadow and not the reality. You know what I mean by that. Sometimes shadows can look a lot like the reality. I remember when we lived in the trailer in Florida, we had a door with a mirror on the back of it. We always left that door open, because if you left it closed and got up in the night and walked toward that door, it looked just like another person was coming toward you. And you'd do all kind of unreasonable things and make strange and frightening noises yourself, because it looked like another person was coming that way. When the shadow begins to look like the reality, we're in trouble. And when we confuse the one for the other, we've made a big mistake. My dad claims that he travels a lot now because he looked at National Geographic's when he was a small boy and began to see all those exotic places. You may be surprised to know that National Geographic was printed when he was a small boy. But it was. They hand drew the pictures, I think. But the point is, that National Geographic was only a shadow of the real place. They had a drawing of Niagara Falls and Victoria Falls and the Taj Mahal and other places, but they weren't real. Now, looking at that, if you treat it right, should give you a taste for those things, right? And it'd make you want to go there. On the other hand, if you took the view that this is the most enjoyable thing I have ever done, I never want to leave these books. I want to look at these books forever. I want to have more of these books. How will you really ever enjoy the reality that's behind those, you see? And when a young child, a young girl, plays with dolls, that's just a shadow of being a real mother. And if she grows up and she's still playing with the doll, something's wrong. She has lost the view, the vision of what's the reality behind that shadow. Boys play with model cars. Those are just shadows of the real thing. And if as an adult, there's no understanding of a real car, only the understanding of the small toys, that person has never really grown to their full potential. This is serious, I think, in our life. And in a pleasant situation like we have in this country, we often confuse the shadow for the reality. And we often sacrifice the reality for the shadow. That's the sad part. A person is so determined to have a particular thing that they give up their treasure in heaven. They're so determined to marry a particular person that they give up their real husband, who is Jesus, to be married someday. There's so many things that we have that can distract us from our true destiny. But it's only a shadow. And we're playing with paper dolls and looking at postcards instead of going to the real place and having the real treasures. That's a danger for us, isn't it? Maybe that's why a lesson on heaven is important to us when things are comfortable. Because we need to remember that it's an imperfect shadow that we have in this life. There's a third point to be made, I think, from this discussion. And that is that this life is not only just a shadow with respect to the things that we enjoy, and it's not really the reality, but it's also the beginning of a transformation process. We have begun as Christians to change. This seed that we talked about that was planted, this treasure that's in an earthen vessel, is something that's been responsive to the character of God, and we've begun to actually change over time. There's a couple of ways to illustrate this. You know, in Romans 6 and chapter 4, Paul talks about baptism. And he says that, you know, like as Christ was buried, so you have been buried with him in baptism, and you've been raised to walk in newness of life. Now, that's a beginning, isn't it? We have a new life already. It's a new life that's led by the Spirit, that is God's will working through our minds to make our bodies do what's right. And we're really, in a sense, resurrected from that old man of sin, though it still has a pull. You understand that. We use that imagery a lot. But do you realize in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 4, he says, we are in this tent grown, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. We've overcome death in the sense that we have put to death the sin that's in our members, and we have the hope of escaping death in the ultimate sense. But we still, that's only the beginning. We still look to a time when that's perfected. And the mortality is, you notice the imagery there? It's just swallowed up. It's gone. That's the end of it. There's no more trace of it. It's swallowed up in immortality. Seems to me these are parallel. Yes, we've been raised. We have a new life now. But that's just a beginning, a very small beginning of something greater that's to come. Another passage we often quote, we've been translated out of the power of darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son, Colossians 1:13. But here in 1 Corinthians 15, where we read, it says, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. Now, how can that be? We've been translated into the kingdom, but eventually we can't make it if we're just flesh and blood. And of course, in the context, he says, what you get is something better than flesh and blood, a spiritual body suitable to that spiritual kingdom. So being translated into the kingdom is only the beginning to being translated into that full understanding, that full unity, that full subjection to God that's to come in the eternal kingdom, as described in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 through 53. Look at 1 John chapter 3. I think that's a very expressive passage that has to do with the beginning of our transformation. Beginning in verse 1, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called the children of God. Therefore the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God. You see, we have already begun that change. We are children of God today. We are. And it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. That's in the life to come. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You see, the idea there is that we've begun, that as we are children of God, we don't quite fully understand what we're going to be, but whatever it is, it's going to be like Jesus. But notice the application in verse 3 that we should make here. And everyone that has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. We must make a beginning and do what we can in this life to be ready for our destiny to come. And that includes being buried with Christ in baptism and sharing in his death to do away with that old man of sin. And it involves a resolve to begin in a new life as best we can in our best behavior, striving to please God and be recognized by him. And that's the beginning. But it's only about beginning, a small beginning. And here in 1 John, it talks about the fact that we purify ourselves because we just want to, as much as we can achieve it, be like Christ. And then at the end of time, our destiny is to be transformed, to be given a new body, to have all the remains of mortality swallowed up in immortality, and have that perfecting process completed by the power of God, which he's demonstrated already in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Lesson on heaven is, in a way, a long view. You think about, well, that's way off in the future. But it really reaches down to right now. Right now is a decision point. Are we perfecting ourselves? Are we pushing aside the shadows and looking for the reality? Are we determined to satisfy our needs here really by an ultimate home in heaven and not by whatever we can accumulate in this life? The way to begin is, of course, as we just read, to be buried with Christ in baptism, to have those sins washed away. And to begin as much as possible to purify ourselves through repentance and through letting the Word of God rule in our lives as the source of our decision-making for all that we do. And looking forward to that hope that is to come when our bodies are redeemed, and all the vanity that surrounds us in this life is taken away, and we can for once enjoy the true pleasures that God had intended for us from the very beginning of time. If you need to do something in obedience to the gospel that we can help with in a public way, we'd encourage you to come at this time while we stand and sing.